While it's vital to try to rein in excessive leverage and risk-taking on Wall Street, that leverage and risk-taking is generally a reflection of excess optimism in society as a whole. Regulators and policymakers aren't immune to those manias. Human beings are inherently susceptible to irrational exuberance as well as irrational fears, and markets that overshoot on the way up tend to overshoot on the way down. Mania and panic both seem to be contagious. But that's not an argument for passivity or inaction before a crisis hits. Even though there's no silver bullet capable of eradicating financial crises forever, there's a lot government officials can do to try to reduce the vulnerability of the financial system to crises and to make crises less frequent and less likely to spiral out of control. The U.S. government was not well prepared for the fire of 2008, which helps explain why it burned so hot, why the efforts to contain it often seemed so messy, and even why that response became so wildly unpopular. Better preparation could have created better outcomes. If the regulatory system had been less balkanized and more capable of addressing the risks outside commercial banks, if crisis managers had been empowered all along to use overwhelming force to avoid financial collapse, and if there had been mechanisms in place from the start to ensure that the financial system would pay for its own rescue, the fire would have been less intense and the firefighting would have seemed less inconsistent and unfair. A decade later, the vital question to ask is whether the United States is better prepared today. We believe the answer is yes and no. There are better safeguards in place to avoid a panic in the first place, the financial equivalent of more aggressive fire prevention measures and stronger fire-resistant building codes. But the emergency authorities for government officials to respond when an intense crisis does happen are in many ways even weaker than they were in 2007, the financial equivalent of less well-equipped firefighters and shuttered firehouses. The government's ability to respond to a collapse in economic demand with monetary and fiscal stimulus, its so-called Keynesian arsenal, has also been significantly depleted. In short, the U.S. economy and financial system today may be less prone to modest brush fires, but more vulnerable to a major inferno if, despite updated and improved fire codes, a conflagration were to begin. To use a different analogy, it's as if policymakers had reacted to a public health disaster by expanding immunizations, promoting good nutrition, and encouraging annual checkups, but also decided to shut down emergency rooms and outlaw life-saving surgeries. Stronger defenses. It's worth recapping why the system was so unsafe before the 2008 crisis, because it helps illuminate the path toward greater safety now. Again, the basic problems were too much risky leverage, too much runnable short-term financing, and the migration of too much risk to shadow banks where regulation was negligible and the Fed's emergency safety net was inaccessible. There were also too many major firms that were too big and interconnected to fail without threatening the stability of the system, and the explosion of opaque mortgage-backed derivatives had turned the health of the housing market into a potential vector for panic. Meanwhile, America's regulatory bureaucracy was fragmented and outdated, with no one responsible for monitoring and addressing systemic risks. Nobody knows exactly what the next financial crisis will look like, but historically, crises have followed a similar mania-panic-crash pattern of excessive risk-taking and leverage. After the crisis, Ben and Tim thought the most important safeguards would be stricter limits on the risk firms could take with borrowed money. That meant requiring them to hold more loss-absorbing capital. Tim's mantra was capital, 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 and take on less leverage, the flip side of capital. That also meant more conservative liquidity requirements, forcing lenders to hold more cash and other liquid assets while relying less on short-term financing that could run at the first sign of trouble. The largest firms, which would pose the greatest danger if they defaulted on their obligations, would be subject to even tougher constraints on their risk-taking and their funding. Most important, the new rules would have to be applied more broadly across the financial system, not only in the United States but around the world, with flexibility to expand them further in the future to help prevent the migration of risk outside the perimeter of the rules toward the path of least regulatory resistance. The Obama administration and the Fed worked hard to achieve those goals, negotiating with Congress over the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010 for the United States, while leading a global effort to apply tougher constraints on risk-taking across the largest economies. And in those areas, the negotiations produced much more robust defenses against potential crises. The Basel III global regulatory regime tripled the minimum capital requirements for banks and quadrupled them for the largest banks, while also requiring higher quality capital that could truly absorb losses, ensuring that the global system would have much hardier shock absorbers. The standards the Fed crafted for U.S. banks were even tougher. Liquidity requirements were also enhanced worldwide, reducing the reliance of financial institutions on unstable overnight funding. Before the crisis, uninsured short-term liabilities amounted to about one-third of the assets in the financial system. Today, they are only about one-sixth. The repo market is much smaller, the assets it finances are much safer, and intraday credit, the riskiest element of repo, is down 90% from the pre-crisis peak. Not only are these risk-taking restrictions tougher, they are also broader, applying not only to traditional commercial banks, but to broker-dealers and other non-banks that used to operate in the shadows. Before the crisis, firms holding only 42% of the assets in the financial system faced significant constraints on their leverage. Now that figure has risen to 88%. Furthermore, the reforms targeted financial instruments and funding markets as well as individual firms. For example, Dodd-Frank required most derivatives to be traded openly on public exchanges rather than negotiated in private deals, reducing the danger that uncertainty about which firms are exposed to which risks would again stoke panic. The law also imposed more conservative margin requirements for derivatives trades, repo borrowing, and securities lending, another way of discouraging excessive speculation. The average daily volume of securities lending dropped from $2.5 trillion to $1 trillion between 2008 and 2015. And several risky classes of funding vehicles that created problems for institutions like Bear Stearns and Citi got wiped out during the crisis and have not reemerged. The post-crisis reforms also tried to limit the risk that the failure of a large bank could destabilize the broader system. A systemic surcharge on the largest banks requires them to hold more capital than smaller institutions against a given amount of risk, reducing their ability to take on leverage and increasing their buffers against losses. Dodd-Frank also included language barring mergers that would concentrate more than 10% of the system's liabilities in a single bank, empowering the Fed to break up banks it considered a serious threat to the stability of the system, and requiring the Fed to conduct annual stress tests of big banks to make sure they're prepared for the most adverse economic and financial scenarios. In 2018, some bipartisan tweaks from Congress raised the threshold for firms to face automatic stress tests from $50 billion to $250 billion in assets, but the Fed still has the power to test any firm it considers a potential systemic threat. As time passes and memories fade, it will be vital that the inevitable pressures to push the pendulum back toward a softer approach do not recreate the vulnerabilities that existed before the crisis. But so far, virtually all of the core Dodd-Frank reforms remain in place, and while some critics initially attacked them as a massive overreach that would cripple the financial system, the system has proved strong enough to support a sustained economic expansion. Other critics attacked the Dodd-Frank reforms for preserving too much of the status quo instead of breaking up big banks immediately and reinstating the Depression-era Glass-Steagall Act rules that separated commercial banking from more speculative investment banking. Those more radical measures would have been heavy lifts in Congress, but that's not why we didn't pursue them. We simply didn't believe they would address the root causes of the crisis or limit the risk of future crises. After all, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and AIG were non-banks that would have been unaffected by Glass-Steagall, while Wachovia and Washington Mutual were banks that got into trouble the old-fashioned way by making bad loans. Bigness is not always a negative. The crisis would have been much worse if J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo hadn't been huge enough to swallow not quite as huge Bear, WaMu, Countrywide, Merrill Lynch, and Wachovia before they collapsed. And smallness is not always a positive. A cascade of failures by relatively tiny banks helped trigger the Great Depression. In any case, the nation's largest banks have performed quite well over their first 8 years of stress testing under Dodd-Frank. In 2018, the Fed concluded they would still have more capital after a severe global recession, with losses larger than those experienced in the 2007 to 2009 crisis, than they had during the good times before the crisis. And a report back in 2014 by the Government Accountability Office, commissioned by congressional critics who expected it to prove the too-big-to-fail problem was worse than ever, found the biggest banks could no longer borrow at much lower rates than small banks, a sign markets are less convinced that they are too big to fail. We would have liked to see more restructuring of the antiquated financial regulatory system, a key element of Hank's original blueprint for reform, with the Fed in charge of monitoring systemic risks and several redundant agencies consolidated to create more consistency and accountability. But the political turf battles were daunting, and this felt like a war of choice rather than a war of necessity. The Fed faced a fierce backlash after the crisis, and Congress had no interest in giving it sweeping new powers. Dodd-Frank did create a Financial Stability Oversight Council, FSOC, of regulators led by the Treasury Secretary, which at least made one government body, though not a single agency, responsible for assessing and limiting risks across the financial system. And the FSOC does have the power to act to minimize systemic risks it detects, including the power to designate any financial institution as systemically important and therefore subject to stricter supervision by the Fed. Dodd-Frank also took a tentative step toward reorganization by abolishing the Office of Thrift Supervision, the perennially captured regulator of Countrywide, WaMu, and AIG. Otherwise, though, every agency in the federal org chart survived. Tim initially hoped to merge the SEC, the watchdog for securities markets, and the CFTC, the overseer of derivatives markets, but turf wars between the congressional committees overseeing the two agencies made the idea a political non-starter. Dodd-Frank even added an agency to that cluttered org chart, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which consolidated the consumer protection divisions of all the other regulators into one powerful new cop on the financial beat. But it made sense to create a one-stop shop for consumer protection, which had often languished inside agencies with other priorities. Aggressive enforcement of fraud in consumer credit markets, in addition to helping ordinary Americans keep more of their money, could enhance financial stability as well by cracking down on the kind of shoddy underwriting and other predatory behaviors that caused so many problems in the mortgage market. Together, these reforms should reduce the frequency of crises. The new rules are already forcing financial institutions, especially larger financial institutions, to hold more and higher quality capital, accumulate less leverage, and finance themselves in safer ways, and annual stress tests are making sure they're preparing for worst-case scenarios. The derivatives market is less evocative of the Wild West. Consumer protections have been enhanced, and there is finally a government body responsible for monitoring potential dangers to the entire system. But stronger rules and stricter oversight will never prevent all financial crises. Vigilant regulators can recognize warning signs, especially extended credit booms, but they can never be sure which booms reflect manias or when those manias will flip into panics. Even if the new rules somehow keep up with innovations in financial markets, they won't eradicate human frailty or herd behavior, so they won't stop every long wave of optimism and complacency from overcorrecting into a crisis of confidence. Policymakers need to have humility about their ability to identify and correct dangerously contagious beliefs, or to prevent them from sparking panics. If bubbles were as easy to identify as many seem to think, investors would never get caught up in them. Even thick capital buffers, the most robust defense against unexpected adversity, can be inadequate protections against all-out runs. As we saw in 2008, capital cushions can seem safe and adequate until suddenly they aren't. The amount of private capital U.S. banks have raised since the crisis would have been enough to cover all their losses during the crisis, a welcome step toward safety. But those losses would have been much worse if Washington's forceful use of monetary and fiscal stimulus hadn't staunched the economic bleeding. And as the traumas of 2008 recede further into the distance, extended periods of stability could encourage renewed complacency. Policymakers may be tempted to soften the post-crisis restrictions on risk-taking, and markets could again get comfortable financing significant amounts of maturity transformation outside the perimeter of strict regulatory oversight. It's worth remembering how much leveraged risk-taking migrated away from banks before the crisis, even when capital requirements were much lower. Now the incentives to find new opportunities for regulatory arbitrage are even stronger, and regulation tends to fall behind the curve. It's certainly conceivable that the world will get better at anticipating and preempting shocks. Central banks and international institutions have invested heavily in financial stability units that try to identify danger signs through big data illustrated with elaborate heat maps, and we wish them well. But we suspect that neither high-tech monitoring nor prudential supervision will fully protect the financial system from the failures of imagination and limitations of memory that seem hardwired in human beings. Eventually, a threat will be overlooked and a crisis will erupt. As the New York Fed's Meg McConnell likes to say, we spend a lot of time looking for systemic risk, but it tends to find us. That's when government responders need a safety net, and we're afraid America's is even more riddled with holes than it was before the crisis. Weaker emergency arsenal. The story of how the crisis happened is a complex story about risky leverage, runnable funding, shadow banking, rampant securitization, and outdated regulation. But the story of how the crisis got so terrible is a comparatively simple story about the weak and antiquated arsenal of emergency weapons we had to fight it. When Tim started at the New York Fed in 2003, he read its doomsday book outlining its break-the-glass emergency powers, and he wasn't impressed. Ben had a similar experience when he became Fed chairman in 2006 and asked for a briefing on crisis-fighting tools. The Fed had broad powers to lend to banks against solid collateral, but it could only lend to non-banks in a crisis if it invoked its 13(3) emergency powers, and even then only if the potential borrowers were near or past the point of no return. Its authority was surprisingly crimped. For example, its power to buy financial assets was limited to treasuries and low-risk securities guaranteed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, while other central banks could buy much riskier securities and, in some cases, equities. And as Hank learned, Treasury had virtually no standing authority to intervene in a crisis, which was a problem, because systemic crises don't just peter out. There's no way to quell a severe panic without government action that substitutes sovereign credit for private credit and assumes losses the market won't bear. No private institution can self-insure against a 100-year flood. During the crisis, the Fed stretched its lender of last resort programs to the edges of its authority, and they proved to be effective tools for providing liquidity to cash-strapped institutions and propping up faltering credit markets. But conventional and even unconventional lending cannot magically restore confidence in troubled firms or troubled assets during a truly systemic crisis. The Fed also reinterpreted its emergency lending authority in creative ways to avert catastrophic collapses of Bear Stearns and AIG, But those last-ditch rescues didn't restore confidence in the financial system either, because the government had no way to reassure investors and creditors that other major firms wouldn't face similar collapses. Walter Badgett had made the powerful case for why central banks should lend to viable firms against good collateral. This crisis illustrated the limits of Badgett's doctrine. We had to go to Congress at the height of the crisis to get the authority we needed to recapitalize endangered firms, and even then it took time and transparency to reassure the markets that there was no longer a reason to run. We believe that if we had started the crisis with that authority, even if carefully hedged and constrained, we could have acted more forcefully, more swiftly, and more comprehensively, with interventions designed to help restore confidence in the entire system. Instead, we had to rely for most of the crisis on the more limited Fed liquidity tools and ad hoc rescues that kept us from getting out in front of the crisis. After the crisis, Tim and Ben hoped to preserve the new powers we had used to stabilize the system and secure additional authority for first responders to wind down systemically dangerous institutions in an orderly fashion in future crises. The Obama administration also proposed even stronger guarantee powers for the FDIC to reduce the likelihood of a Lehman-type failure and reduce the need for the Fed to orchestrate one-off rescues of individual firms like Bear and AIG. But the TARP authority expired, and the final congressional version of Dodd-Frank curtailed rather than expanded the government's firefighting tools. The FDIC's broad guarantee authority, so effective during the crisis, was eliminated, as was the ability of the Fed to lend to individual non-bank financial firms under its 13(3) emergency powers. The Fed retained the ability under 13(3) to lend to broad classes of institutions, as it had done for primary dealers, and to support important funding markets, as it had done for commercial paper, but with less discretion and less ability to take risk than before. For example, Congress limited the Fed's discretion to judge when its loans are secured to its satisfaction, making it harder for the central bank to accept risky collateral in a future emergency. There was simply no political support for anything that could have been construed as enabling future bailouts. In general, the crisis managers of tomorrow will have less authority and less flexibility to take action to support the financial system than we had. Congress took away the Treasury's power to use the Exchange Stabilization Fund to issue guarantees, even though that power protected the savings of ordinary Americans and vital short-term funding for much of corporate America when money market funds were melting down after the Reserve Primary Fund broke the buck. Congress also curtailed the executive branch's ability to take credit risk alongside the Fed, as it had done to backstop consumer credit markets through the Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility. Dodd-Frank even weakened the Fed's traditional lender of last resort programs, adding disclosure rules that, whatever their benefits in terms of transparency, will increase the potential stigma of taking loans from the Fed, making it harder for the Fed to inject liquidity into the system in future crises. Dodd-Frank did create one important new piece of firefighting equipment, orderly liquidation authority, a bankruptcy-like mechanism for failing complex firms that would allow crisis managers to wind them down without triggering a chaotic collapse, as the FDIC already does for smaller and simpler banks. Our inability to do this during the crisis was a frequent source of frustration, and during Lehman weekend, a source of disaster. The Fed had to stretch its lending authority to avoid a messy failure of Bear, an intervention that worked only because J.P. Morgan was capable of standing behind Bear's obligations, and we had no recourse when we couldn't find a similar buyer for Lehman. The goal of crisis management should not be to prevent all failures, but rather to prevent uncontrolled failures of systemic firms in the midst of a general panic. A well-crafted resolution authority could be an elegant way to avoid chaos while helping to ensure that no financial institution is too big to fail. We won't know how well this new resolution authority will work until it's used, and the three of us do not entirely agree on its promise. We certainly don't want to dismiss the importance of the new resolution regime or the associated living wills that systemically important firms must draw up in good times to help the government wind them down in case of disaster. But it's fair to say that the new authority is likely to be more effective in managing the failure of a Lehman-type firm in an otherwise stable environment than when other firms are also in danger and the entire system is on the edge of panic. Overall, while the United States has much stronger safeguards against the occurrence of panic than it had before the crisis, it has weaker emergency authorities for responding when a panic occurs. Its crisis managers lack the power to inject capital, guarantee liabilities, or purchase assets without going to Congress. Meanwhile, the Fed has lost its power to rescue individual firms and faces new constraints on its lending powers, while the Treasury has lost its ability to use the Exchange Stabilization Fund for guarantees. This has all been done in the name of avoiding government rescues, a worthy goal. But the better way to avoid government rescues is not to hobble the first responders, but to avoid crises in the first place. Eventually, risk tends to weave its way around even the best-designed safeguards. But that is a reason to give crisis managers the authority they need to respond with overwhelming force. You can't wish away fires by closing the firehouse. Of course, when an epic crisis does arrive, Congress would have the power to undo the preemptive limitations it has placed on crisis managers. But that is easier said than done in a non-parliamentary democracy where legislative changes require support from the President, the House of Representatives, and a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. At a minimum, financial firefighters would have to follow our torturous path of spending time, energy, and political capital to get the trucks and hoses they need while the fire is already burning, which can intensify crises and increase their ultimate costs to taxpayers and the economy. And it's hard to look at the bitterly polarized politics of modern America and feel confident that a bipartisan consensus for unpopular but necessary actions would emerge when it mattered most. As bad as the crisis and subsequent recession were, they would have been much worse if the Federal Reserve, the Congress, and the executive branch had not engineered massive monetary and fiscal stimulus to stop the contraction and aid the recovery. Another key lesson of 2008 was that even aggressive measures to stabilize the financial system can't succeed if the economy is imploding, while aggressive measures to revive the economy can't succeed if the financial system is collapsing. Crisis fighting and macroeconomic policies have to work together, and a government's ability to limit the intensity of a financial crisis depends on its macroeconomic room for maneuver. Fortunately, before the crisis, America's Keynesian arsenal was reasonably well stocked. The Fed had plenty of room to lower interest rates and pursue other expansionary monetary policies, while the rest of the government had the budgetary space to undertake expansionary fiscal policies like tax cuts and increased spending. Today, the Keynesian arsenal looks far more constrained, which could be a significant handicap in a serious crisis. And while the Fed has gradually raised interest rates, which will help replenish the monetary ammunition it deployed during the last crisis, Washington's political branches are squandering their fiscal ammunition when they ought to be gathering more. On the monetary side, the United States entered the crisis with the federal funds rate at 5.25%, modest by historical standards, but comfortably above zero, and Ben had already suggested he'd be willing to take unorthodox actions to support a flagging economy when the federal funds rate hit the zero lower bound. The Fed may have been a bit too tentative in the early months of the crisis, but it cut rates more quickly than any other central bank starting in early 2008. It lowered rates to the zero lower bound during the darkest days of the fall, and it kept them there to support the economic recovery for 7 years. The Fed's three rounds of quantitative easing also provided significant fuel for growth, helping the economy weather a series of negative events, including a sovereign debt crisis in Europe, without lapsing back into recession. and its purchases of mortgage-backed securities were crucial to the recovery of the housing market. Ben's successors at the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen and Jerome Powell, have begun a gradual process of unwinding the $4.5 trillion book of securities the Fed accumulated through quantitative easing, while slowly nudging interest rates above 2% as we write these words. However, it appears that even once monetary policy returns to a neutral stance, the prevailing interest rates will be lower than in the past. If so, the Fed won't have as much headroom to loosen policy with rate cuts if the economy falters, which could hinder efforts to fight a future crisis or recession. On the fiscal side, the federal deficit at the onset of the last crisis was only about 1% of GDP. That increased dramatically once the Great Recession began and tax revenues withered, but the United States still had a fair amount of fiscal capacity to support the economy by expanding deficits in the short term without busting the budget for the long term. And it did. The $150 billion tax cut Hank negotiated early in the crisis, Obama's $800 billion Recovery Act, and the series of smaller follow-up stimulus measures added up to more than 10% of GDP. Even though some of this federal stimulus was offset by state and local budget cuts and tax increases, and we believe Washington pivoted too quickly toward fiscal austerity after the recovery began, it's clear that the injection of government adrenaline into the economic bloodstream helped end the recession and launch a gradual recovery, while helping to avert a collapse of the financial system. After ballooning above $1 trillion during the crisis, the deficit initially fell back to earth as the emergency subsided, the financial rescues were repaid, and the economy rebounded, while Congress raised taxes and cut the rate of growth in spending. But now the annual deficit is soaring above $1 trillion again because of major tax cuts unaccompanied by spending restraint. As an aging population puts additional strain on future entitlement obligations, the United States could face unsustainable long-term deficits as far as the eye can see. The federal debt held by the public has already risen from 31% of GDP in 2001 to 76% today, and interest payments alone cost more than $300 billion a year. When the next crisis or even an ordinary downturn hits, depressing tax revenues and making the deficit even worse, policymakers will find it much more difficult, both politically and economically, to match the forceful response of a decade ago. In other words, the use of fiscal adrenaline could be limited just when it is needed most. It will take a long period of less profligate policy choices and benign economic conditions to restore America's macroeconomic firepower to levels that could help end another emergency. Right now, even a modest recession could leave Washington without much fiscal leeway to respond to a financial crisis, or for that matter, to upgrade infrastructure, tackle the opioid epidemic, address climate change, stabilize Social Security, or provide permanent tax relief for hardworking families. America was grappling with rising income inequality, middle-class insecurity, and other economic challenges well before the crisis of 2008. But the crisis made them worse, and unsustainable budget deficits could hobble our ability to deal with them. The financial system seems stronger today, and in some ways the economy seems more stable as well. Banks are safer and are providing the credit the economy needs to grow. But the world is full of risks. Although the extreme crisis is rare, someday it will come. And even though Washington is mired in a noisy state of gridlock, now is as good a time as any to fill in the gaps in the 2010 reforms and help prepare for the worst. That's the way to make sure the worst doesn't happen. As the Chinese philosopher and military strategist Sun Tzu supposedly warned, if you want peace, prepare for war. What is to be done? For us, the crisis still feels like yesterday, as it does to many Americans whose lives and livelihoods were disrupted and damaged by those events. But markets have short memories, and as history has demonstrated, Long periods of confidence and stability can produce overconfidence and instability. Rules that seem necessary in the aftermath of a disaster start to feel onerous in calmer times. The enemy is forgetting. The current regulatory burden has not prevented banks from enjoying healthy profits or lending record amounts to households and businesses, but the financial industry is pushing hard for regulatory relief. We believe the first rule for additional financial reform should be Hippocratic. First, do no harm. We should be careful, even as we refine some of the post-crisis reforms, not to allow a general weakening of the most powerful defenses against crisis. When times are good, the dangers of backsliding can seem negligible. But the costs of the worst financial crises can be so enormous that there ought to be a serious push for even stronger measures both to prevent them and to mitigate them when they occur. It's hard to get the political system to act without a crisis to force its hand, as we learned with our early proposals to fix Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. In times of calm, politicians are especially reluctant to give central bankers and finance ministries sufficient power to respond to future turbulence, as if the mere existence of a firehouse might cause fires. But it's much safer to give firefighters the firefighting authority they need before the fire starts burning. And the stakes are high enough that Washington ought to treat financial stability as an emergency before it becomes one. When it comes to crisis prevention, the new capital, leverage, liquidity, and margin rules are much stronger than the safeguards in place before the crisis, and the main challenge for reformers will be to beat back the pressure to weaken them. A related challenge will be that market participants will adapt to the new rules over time, diverting risk to areas where oversight seems looser, so regulators will need the discretion to adapt as well. Commercial banks are still a smaller portion of the U.S. financial system than they are in other major economies, and vigilance will be required to ensure that risky leverage doesn't migrate to new shadows. The next war is unlikely to unfold in exactly the same way as the last one, so it will be vital to make sure regulators have enough flexibility to monitor new dangers as they arise. The balkanized financial regulatory system could still use reform as well, to reduce turf battles among redundant agencies with overlapping responsibilities. We realize reorganization would be a heavy lift on Capitol Hill, but a more rational regulatory structure could help prevent the Lehman's, AIG's, and WaMu's of tomorrow from falling through the regulatory cracks. Otherwise, though, financial fire prevention is in decent shape. As we've emphasized in this chapter, we're more worried about the ill-equipped financial firehouse. We know the public is not clamoring to make it easier for our successors to rescue banks, but disempowering financial rescuers will not prevent financial rescues. It will only delay them and make them much costlier. Somehow, Washington needs to muster the courage to restock the emergency arsenal with the tools that helped end the crisis of 2008, the authority for crisis managers to inject capital into banks, buy their assets, and especially to guarantee their liabilities, the most powerful weapon governments have for quelling panics. The FDIC already has most of these authorities when dealing with commercial banks, and we should be investigating how to extend them to any institution engaged in maturity transformation. The resolution authority in Dodd-Frank also needs to be enhanced, so that when large, complicated banks are on the brink of failure, the FDIC can fully stand behind their obligations while winding them down in an orderly fashion. That may create some short-term losses for taxpayers, but the FDIC can recoup those losses from the industry after the crisis passes. By contrast, imposing haircuts on creditors in the midst of a crisis can accelerate a systemic panic and drag down additional firms, which ultimately creates much larger losses for taxpayers. The impulse to ensure that risk-takers pay a price for their risk-taking is understandable, but requiring crisis managers to extract that price when the crisis is raging only makes it harder to end the crisis. What makes the FDIC model work so well is that it requires financial firms to pay into an insurance fund prospectively before a crisis strikes, and makes clear that if the price of stabilizing the system turns out to be steeper than anticipated, the industry will eventually foot the bill. We would like to see Congress adopt a similar insurance model that would work for the broader financial system, so crisis managers would have the leeway to put public dollars at risk with the assurance that any shortfalls would ultimately be repaid by financial institutions rather than taxpayers. We're not so naive as to think this would solve the political problems of financial crisis management. Government efforts to calm financial panics will always be susceptible to attack as unwarranted bailouts for irresponsible speculators. But an upfront legal mandate that the financial industry will pay all the costs of financial firefighting could at least reduce those concerns. We achieved this in practice in that our approach essentially forced the financial system to pay for the protection we provided, but it would be better if that principle was clear and understood in advance. Finally, we hope that now that the sun is shining, Washington will use this opportunity to fix its economic roof before the next hard rain. This would begin with a new commitment to fiscal responsibility, because the current dessert-over-vegetables approach of slashing taxes while boosting spending in good times will make it impossible to provide fiscal stimulus in bad times. But we should also be taking steps to address long-standing structural problems, including growing disparities in income that undermine the health of both our economy and our democracy. We need to find ways to have more Americans participate in the nation's economic success. Not only is that the right thing to do, but a stronger economy with more opportunity and prosperity for people from all walks of life will leave the country better prepared to withstand the shocks that economies are heir to, including financial shocks. Unfortunately, our divided and paralyzed political system seems incapable of thinking ahead and making tough choices about the future. A decade ago, we did see Democrats and Republicans set aside political and ideological differences to save the country from catastrophe, reinforcing the belief that the United States, when confronted with crisis, and only when confronted with crisis, tends to do what is necessary. But that was hard to do at the time, and it might be harder in a future crisis. We are not naive about the difficulties of getting it done before the next crisis hits. Still, the current mix of constraints on the emergency policy arsenal is dangerous for the United States, and, considering the global importance of the U.S. financial system and the dollar, dangerous for the world. We can do better, and the stakes are so huge that doing even a little better could have tremendous benefits in terms of improved well-being. There's no time like the present to start. This is Mark Deakins. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Firefighting, The Financial Crisis and Its Lessons by Ben S. Bernanke, Timothy F. Geithner, and Henry M. Paulson, Jr. This program was directed by John Doolittle. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2019 by Ben S. Bernanke, Timothy F. Geithner, and Henry M. Paulson, Jr. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.